This morning, we begin arguments for the Northern Panel. The first case on calendar today is case number 60896, Bond versus Doss. Are counsel ready to proceed? Good morning, Ms. Rice.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Mr. O'Meara. All right, Ms. Rice, if you would begin, please.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Your Honors, I can tell you what this case is about and why we're here in 90 seconds. In 2008, respondent wrote a letter demanding wages from appellant. This was not true, so appellant filed a claim for defamation against respondent. In return, respondent filed a counterclaim, which demands half of the profits from the sale of the property plus a wage of $8.50 per hour. Business profits was not an issue in either one of those documents.
What was the nature, from your point of view, what was the nature of their business relationship entirely?
The nature of their business relationship is somewhat unconventional in that they were brothers.
Correct.
They were brothers, and Mr. Doss ran the business day-to-day for Mr. Bond.
And what was he to get in return?
In return, the agreement was profits from the business, which was separate from
the property. So they were partners?
Essentially, but they were not equity partners. There was just an agreement.
So it's here, you work. You might get something if we have a profit from the business, otherwise you get nothing?
Well, I wouldn't say nothing. The record reflects that he was provided room and board and meals from the business while he was working there as well. And he also was provided a vehicle to drive.
Does that violate employment laws? Any federal regulations or laws? Isn't he entitled to at least minimum wage if he's working in a business? Unless he's a partner?
I don't know the answer to that, and that wasn't an issue in the case. After a four-day jury trial, the jury returned a special verdict finding that there was a valid contract, but that the contract did not provide for wages, it didn't provide for profit from the sale of the property, it did not provide for wages at the rate of $8.50 an hour, and then the jury inconsistently found that Mr. Doss had actual damages of $8.50 per hour. There was no mention in the special verdict form of business profits either, because again, business profits was not an issue in this case. This matter wouldn't be before this court right now if the district court had used the proposed special verdict form. The only difference between the proposed and the one that was actually used clarifies question number one when it asks if there was a contract. It's for something more than the splitting of profits from the operation of the business. Had this been used, the answer would have been no, as clarified by the jury on the record, and we wouldn't have the inconsistencies with the damages set forth in the actual special verdict form.
Well, didn't the district court do as we require, alertly notice the conflict, call counsel into chambers, and assess what should be done with respect to the potential conflict, and then canvass the jury, and they obtained an explanation from the jury, did they not?
The district court did do that. I would submit that the problem is that the district court only went halfway. After clarifying that there was an inconsistency in the verdict, instead of sending them back for further deliberations or instruction, the court simply rested on the inconsistencies as they were clarified by the jury.
I believe I read in the transcript on this subject, Mr. Hardy saying at page 630 of the record at line 12, I would like to hear from the juror that disagrees. And before that, he had indicated that on page 629, in the interest of time, I think Mr. O'Meara is willing to do it, referring to a public canvas of the jury about their explanation rather than sending them back. So now on appeal, you say that the district court committed error in accepting what your colleague proposed and the other side agreed to?
No. I think that the error is that after the clarification was made on the record, I think at that point in time, the jury should have been sent back. But at that point in time, after trial counsel, Mr. Hardy, requested to hear from the dissenting juror, indicating that it may make a difference in the case, the district court very abruptly stated that damages are up to the discretion of the jury and then released them.
Isn't it necessary for counsel, when that happens, to raise an objection and ask for further clarification? Counsel can't just sit there and do nothing if they're dissatisfied with the explanation that's been given to reconcile the conflict in the verdict, can they?
I believe that was the law prior to, and the precedent that this court had upheld prior to, the Lehrer-McGovern case, which, based on NRCP 49B, heavily decided that matter on the basis of the fact that the trial court has an affirmative duty, if there's a blatant inconsistency on the face of the jury verdict, to correct it before dismissing the jury.
Well, but Lehrer-McGovern doesn't say once the judge does what Lehrer-McGovern asks them to do, which is what Judge Palaha was doing here, that the lawyer can then just do nothing further. Isn't the lawyer obligated to say, well, wait a minute, Judge, before you release them, I'm not satisfied with this explanation. I object.
I think the affirmative duty on the part of the district court as opposed to trial counsel comes from 49B, which states that the trial court should not enter the judgment if it's inconsistent. And I don't believe that there's any waiver by trial counsel failing to again raise that matter after the clarification was made, because I believe the error came in not sending them after the clarification. Because had the clarification maybe indicated that there was a contract for wages, that would have fixed everything. But because the jury's clarification indicated that they found for something that wasn't an issue in the case, I believe at that time it was apparent that the verdict was still inconsistent and the jury should have been sent back.
You argue the jury shouldn't have used an hourly wage rate to determine the profits that were retained in the company. Could you expand on that argument? In effect, it's a sufficiency of evidence argument, is that right?
Yes. Damages must be based on substantial evidence, and the majority of the cases relied upon by respondent in this matter deal with personal injury cases, and that is that the jury has wide latitude and discretion in finding damages. That's not so when there is a legal measure of damages. Here, the jury was provided no instruction on damages from profits from the business and instead substituted wages for a contract that wasn't for wages. There's no substantial evidence in the record, and the plaintiff, who was the counterclaimant in this matter, would have had the burden to provide the evidence by which it was seeking damages for, and that burden wasn't met.
The evidence then is that there were no profits at the time the business was sold.
There was discussion that there was no profits at the time that the business was sold.
But didn't the parties agree that profits had been put back into the business to effectuate repairs and other improvements to the business?
Yes, both parties testified to
that. Was there any evidence to quantify that retention of profits?
No, and again, the reason why there was no evidence is because there was no discovery done regarding the issue of business profits.
But, okay, there was no disagreement then that money that otherwise would be considered profits went back into the building, went back into the business itself. And had there been profits, the respondent would have been entitled to a portion of those profits, correct?
Possibly.
Okay.
I mean,
and those went back into the business itself and the building specifically?
There was testimony regarding the money that went back into the building was partially for lease payments because the business and the building were separate. But in effect, there were no profits at the end of the day. And there's no way to quantify what went back in or what didn't because there was no discovery, there was no accounting done on that issue.
What about the profits that were put in other investments?
That was based on testimony from appellant and respondent. And again, there's no way to quantify the amount or what was put into the other businesses and other properties because it wasn't an issue in the case.
So your argument is that that the brother's liable for at least there's liability in this case, but there's no damages is what you're saying?
Correct. Sort of. Because at the same time, there's liability for an issue that wasn't raised in this case.
So he's not entitled to anything for the work that he put in?
Well, he did receive room and board. He traveled during his time. He was provided a vehicle to drive. He used a company credit card.
Well, the jury didn't buy that, that's for sure. And not when they give a $154,000 verdict to the respondent in this case. It's hard to believe that they bought your argument just now. I mean, you're arguing something that the jury didn't buy.
And I would agree with that, but the jury doesn't have the ability to act as a court of equity and say, well, we don't think that there's a contract for what you're saying there is a contract for, but we kind of like that guy, so we're going to give him some damages anyway.
Well, I don't know. I tried a lot of cases, and nobody ever liked my client enough for $150,000, so I think you're barking up the wrong tree, Ms. Rice.
And I think that that goes against the precedent that juries can't base their verdict on emotion or prejudice to the client, and that appears to be exactly what happened here.
Ms. Rice, could I clarify something in your argument? Did not the counterclaim include a request for profits?
Profits from the sale of the building, not profits from the sale of the business.
Mm-hmm. But the money that was retained by the business went into the building?
Some of it.
Yeah. Okay. Did you want to reserve the remainder of your time, or did you have something further you wanted to discuss?
I would like to reserve the remainder.
Okay, thanks, Ms. Rice. Mr. O'Meara?
May it please the Court, my name is David O'Meara, and I represent the respondent, Mr. Hemdas, in this case. We're here today to ask you to confirm and affirm the District Court's judgment, as we believe the substantial evidence certainly shows that the district court and the jury, their decisions were correct. You know, there's three issues really here today that we believe show that there should be an affirmance. First, the jury's answer to the special verdict are not inconsistent. They are actually harmonious and consistent with each other. Second, the district court did not abuse its discretion in rejecting appellant's special verdict form. And the third is appellants are not entitled to a second trial. Based upon their claim that there was manifest disregard by the jury. In this case, the jury's answers to this special verdict are harmonious and consistent. The jury found there was a contract. The jury found that Mr. Das had performed under that agreement. The jury found that Mr. Bond breached that agreement. And the jury found that there was substantial damages in the amount of over $150,000.
Now, but as counsel argues, there seemed to be some uncertainty about the nature of the agreement, which was the purpose of their proposed jury instruction, which I can't see, but I've got a copy of it in front of me here. Shouldn't the court have clarified in the instructions and for purposes of the special verdict exactly which agreement and what agreement we're talking about here?
Well, I think that the court did exactly what it was supposed to do in this case. It gave a jury instruction that said, was there a contract? The jury agreed that there was a contract. When that confusion was amounted to, the judge took the affirmative steps to find out what the contract was so that this court and the court itself and the district court has the ability to say this is the legal theory in which the jury based their decision, and which is affirmed or which is acknowledged by the appellants in this case, where they admit and brought out forth that Mr. Doss was entitled to half of the profits of the sale of the business.
But appellant argues that the time to sort out what the terms of the contract are in the jury instructions and in the special verdict, not when you get the special verdict back and it contains an inconsistency on its face. And so there was error, according to appellant, in refusing to give the jury instruction that Ms. Rice referred to in her argument. Why isn't that correct?
Because, first of all, the jury instruction in regards to the appellants, it was unnecessary and didn't conform to the actual facts of this case. The testimony by both parties was that there was an agreement, that Mr. Doss was entitled to one half of the sale of the business. There was testimony by both sides for and against whether or not certain payments were were actually profits of the business. And as Justice Cherry says, the jury, as a trier of fact, looked at that, looked at the credibility of both parties, and determined that those payments that went into offset entities, including the property and other aspects, were actually profits that would have been obtained by Mr. Doss had they not been siphoned off by Mr. Bond in a prudent manner.
Let me try to clarify my question, if I can, Mr. O'Meara. The special verdict form asked the question, did Doss and Bond enter into a valid contract in 98? And the jury says yes. But then questions 2, 3, and 4 seem to pose questions about what is or is not a term in the contract, to which the jury answers no to each one. They say, did the contract provide for the payment of wages? No. Did the contract provide for 50% of the profit of the sale of the property? No. Did the contract provide for the payment of wages at the rate of $8.50 an hour? No. There's no question here, then, as to what the contract did provide for. I guess we're left to assume that it provided for some percentage of the sale of the business.
And I don't think the Supreme Court here needs to assume anything, because the district court did exactly what he was supposed to do and pulled the juror and had the foreman discuss, and the foreman acknowledged what the theory was. Therefore, the court accepted the theory in which there was an agreement that was entered into 1998, and the jury believed that that agreement was based upon the sale of the business.
So your argument is that the court's canvas following the apparent conflict in the verdict cured any error related to the instruction that was tendered by appellant in this case for the judge to give.
That's correct. And I also believe that the special verdict by the appellants would not have done anything to minimize any confusion in regards to that, because it doesn't specifically go towards the actual facts that were testified by both Mr. Doss and Mr. Bond in the case. And that's what the simple jury verdicts are supposed to do. They're supposed to guide the jury into making the decision of whether or not the elements of the claim have been met. And the elements of the claim are of a breach of contract is there a contract? Did Mr. Doss perform under that contract? Did Mr. Bond breach that contract? And were there damages? And on all of those, the decision of the jury was that, yes, there was a contract that was breached and that damages were entitled.
What's your argument with respect to Ms. Rice's claim or contention that the counterclaim did not seek as relief 50% of the profit of the business, whether it was retained or paid out or not paid out?
Right.
The counterclaim simply didn't seek that relief.
Right. And that's in the claim. It was for a breach of contract. And also under the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure, when those type of issues are litigated in the case, they can be an issue that can be tried by the jury. And that is clear that in Mr. Doss's testimony, where he was asked what was the agreement, and he believed that the agreement was he was supposed to get one half of the sale of the property, one half of the sale of the business and his wages, and he specifically said it's all of it. If you look at his testimony, it believes that he considered the business and the properties all at one. So if you look at NRCP 315, what the appellants have tried to do is they've imposed this defense that, oh, well, we don't agree with this other contract, but we're gonna say that there is another contract in that regard. And their argument that says that, oh, there was no discovery, that could have been done by them under the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure. I mean, they're making a defense that there was only a contract in regards to the sale of the business. Under NRCP 16.1 and NRCP 26, initial discoveries require for the disclosure of information that goes to either your claim or your defense. So the fact that they're claiming that profits were not an issue is not correct. Not only did they have the opportunity and notice that there was a breach of contract claim in front of the court, they affirmatively litigated that issue by claiming, by testifying to that, and they also testified as to where the profits went and whether or not those were profits that should have been within the business. And I think that there's no better way of looking at it than when Mr. Bond's own attorney got up during the jury and said to the jury, Mr. Doss is entitled to half of the profits of the operation of the business. And that was to the jury. And the jury took that and accepted that. And they awarded damages in that amount. And so those issues are
why shouldn't litigated. The court remand the case for a trial on damages where there doesn't appear to be any evidence as to what profits were retained by the business?
And I think that there is substantial damage, and I disagree with the appellants that there is nothing in the record. There is, and it's cited in our brief, there is numerous testimony by Mr. Doss in regards to inventory that was sold from the business. There was profits of $5,000 over a period of time that went out of the business for personal use, profits that went out of the business for the property. There's substantial evidence. And the use of the juror and the questioning of the juror clearly goes beyond the actual canvassing of the judge and violates Nevada law in regards to the mental capacity and the emotions of the juror. Not only during the time where the judge specifically said it didn't matter for that jury's discussion to happen, and then additionally when appellant filed an affidavit, which was objected to by respondent and should not be considered in the record in regards to after-fact events. The question isn't how the jury got to the damages. It's whether or not there's substantial evidence within the record to show that the damages are there. And we look at those case law, even the courts have said, specifically in Carlson, where they said, well, this number may not be something that is off with the $177,775. But here there is substantial evidence to show that there are damages in this case, and we should not delve into and change the trier of facts decision that $154,000 is the proper accounting. It doesn't have to be mathematically exact. It just has to be supported by substantial evidence. And I think that the record clearly shows that is found in this case, and there does not need to be a remand for a damages or a remand for an entire trial at that matter.
$154,000 was based upon a wage of $850 an hour times however many hours?
I don't believe that the court should assume that, and I don't think.
No, I'm asking you. You're saying substantial evidence supports $154,000. I want to know how they came to that.
Right, now. And if the $154,000 is based upon the testimony of the parties in regards to how much money was actually taken out of the business and used for other properties, in regards to inventory sale. There was taxes paid on property. There were $5,000 that went outside of the. Outside of the business, and there was testimony by Mr. Bond in regards to what he believed in it and what Mr. Doss believed in it, and it's clear that the jury believed, based on its credibility of the witnesses, which is their sole right to determine, and this court should not impede upon that right, that Mr. Doss was telling was more credible than Mr. Bond, and therefore those amounts are substantially confirmed within the evidence.
And there was testimony about money being diverted to other investments of Bond?
That's correct.
What type of investments did he have other than this?
There was properties that were being, the properties in which the business was in, but there's no evidence showing that the business had to pay any of those profits. There was no evidence that those evidence shows property, also inventory, as well as other additional property across the street from the business as well.
And sold the business for over $1 million?
I don't believe it was $1 million. It was within a realm of, I think, $850,000. So there was substantial increase.
He sold the business or the building?
The building.
Okay, it had nothing to do with the business because the business didn't have any profits, right?
Well, the business had profits, Your Honor, okay. Justice Perry, but the profits were diverted into these other businesses, and the agreement was that he was going to get paid upon the sale of the property. And I that may be confusing to the court because appellant's brief on the first pages said that the complaint says that the sale that Mr. Doss would be paid upon the sale of the business, but that was a misstatement of the citation, and it clearly shows in the even in their boards that they provided today that Mr. Doss would have been paid all of the monies that he was owed in regards to the sale of the property.
When the property was sold, did it remain a convenience store? Was there testimony to that or not?
I don't believe there was any testimony as to whether it remained as a convenience store. In that regard, but I can certainly file a supplemental brief for you, Justice Cherry, if that's an issue for the court. So, in regards to this case, it is clear that the three issues that have been asserted by appellants do not meet the threshold. The jury was proper in their special verdict. The argument that the court should have accepted the special verdict is based on a standard abuse of discretion, and it clearly does not meet that standard. The court did not abuse its discretion. And then there should not be a trial in this case. I think that the court has sufficient evidence in front of it to determine that the jury did exactly what it was supposed to do, that when there was any confusion brought forth by either of the parties, the confusion was alleviated by the judge in that regard, and that any subsequent testimony or statements that were provided by jurors was improper and violative of Nevada rules, Nevada Revised Statute 50.0652A, which delved into the actual mind and emotions of the jurors, not let alone it was only one juror in a number of jurors. So we ask this court to affirm the decision to enter the allow the judgment to be entered. And thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. O'Meara. Any other questions? All right. Ms. Rice?
Thank you, Your Honors. As one point of clarification, in Volume 28 at page 1573, lines 13 through 14, Mr. O'Meara, who is trial counsel, in his closing arguments states, so if you do that, he would be entitled to $154,564 on his wages. That was not based on money put back into the business. That number was arrived at specifically based on counsel's argument of what wages should have been paid. Additionally, I think one of the major issues in the case is whether or not this matter was tried. And I believe that it may be a first impression in front of this court regarding the fact that both parties, both counsel, agreed that there was a contract, and both agreed that the contract for business profits was not before the court at that time. In respondent's counsel's closing argument at volume 28, page 1579, lines 20 through 24, counsel states, if you don't find damages, there's no reason to give him damages. You have to find it specifically here. So if you find that he breached the contract, the next question is, as a result of the breach of that contract, did Mr. Doss suffer a loss? Quote, and that's the amount of the wages and the amount of half the sale of the property. Those are what are Mr. Doss's actual damages? Question mark. Additionally, Mr. Hardy also narrows the issue in his closing without objection, stating, First one it asked is, did Hem Doss and Benad Bond enter into a valid contract in 1998? Quote, that's not talking about the contract that Mr. Bond entered into where he got 50% of the profits of the business. This is the question about what is at issue in this case, and they are saying that it was on wages and one half of the property. Again, that was no objection was made to that, and both parties narrowed the issues to what was before the court. I think in most cases, the issue with trial by consent comes up at the end where somebody tries to introduce a jury instruction on a matter that came up in trial, and opposing counsel then says, no, this isn't an issue. Here, this has never been an issue all the way through closing, and to date, no motion to amend pursuant to 15B has been made. So I would respectfully ask that this court vacate the damages in their entirety because there was no contract for wages and no contract for profits from the sale of the property, which were the issues in this case.
Okay, any questions for Ms. Rice? All right, thank you, Ms. Rice. Mr. O'Meara, thank you for your excellent arguments this morning and your briefing in this case. This case will stand.